Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
I had a conversation with somebody the other day where I thought, as a result, I've come up with one of the benefits of the pandemic, which is I think it's seen the end of social kissing. And I, for one, have to say,
you have an aversion to it.
Relieved to see the end of social kissing, because Mark,
is it you one and I, kiss on you the cheek, or is
hold
it
on,
two?
Just hold on, don't rush me. The you and I are old enough to have seen the advent of social kissing, haven't we?
Oh yeah,
we've seen the great. We remember a time when it just didn't go on at all, did it? Apart from between, you know, close relations or whatever. You know, but it certainly didn't go on in a business context or anything of that kind.
And it accelerated through this to the bear hug almost immediately, didn't it? When did it start? That's a good point.
Well, I don't know when it started, but it just grew and grew and grew. And it got to the stage where you're almost dreading being introduced to generally members of the opposite sex in business context. Well, you didn't know whether you were expected to lunge in there for the kind of one peck of the two pecks or whatever, or wait to be lunged upon. I mean, it was a social minefield.
And also, it took so long, too, because you had to go around each person.
Did you have to do everybody? Did you have to do the people you'd met before than the people you just met now or whatever? I don't know. It was mad. And I realized this the other day when I was in a business meeting where, you know, people were not doing any of that kind of thing and they were not shaking hands or anything. And we were remarking upon the lack of physical contact. And one person at the meeting said that he'd previously worked for an advertising agency. And when he first worked for the advertising agency, they had said to him, being a young chap out of university, dealing with the client, that he was actively encouraged to peck, you know, members of the opposite sex working for the client on the cheek. You know, it was a good thing to do. And we couldn't help reflecting.
User-friendly, customer-facing. Yeah.
But we couldn't help reflecting that his counterpart right now being introduced to that job will be told the exact opposite.
Yeah. On no account. Absolutely. So interesting, when you went into that room the other day, did everybody then just sort of do little nervous waves from a distance?
There's a bit of that.
What did they do?
Yeah. There's a bit of that. They're all kind of trying to decide what to do. And, you know, but there was none of that, you know, close physical contact. And it's just what he said. I thought, God, that's so interesting. Because he went from being, and it's like so many contemporary social codes, they go from becoming compulsory in one direction to becoming compulsory in the opposite direction, with equal force in quite a short period of time. You know what I mean? Because they feel as if they're imposed from above. They don't feel as if they're grown naturally from human behavior. They just feel that's what we've got to do right now because we've decided the world is like this. And then, memo comes along 5 years later, completely different.
About you know? Turn.
And it's just, it made me think. That's all, Mark. That doesn't lead anywhere at all, does it? But anyway, that's my reflection.
It's a very valid reflection. And it, the world is a better place because of it.
And also, I think, didn't we talk about this before? That, or I may have written about this. The greatest living advertisement for affection and friendship of our time being the Beatles. The Beatles hardly ever indulged in any physical demonstrations of affection to each other. Am I right in this? You do not see the Beatles with their arms around each other, do you? I don't think
Very occasionally. But no, that's true. They didn't make a big song and dance out of it, did they?
Whereas nowadays, you know, if you see a band on stage, even if they only met each other about a couple of hours before, at the end of the show, there will be the, you know, the big hug.
Won't
there?
Yeah. With all of them. It has to be. Standing in line. Yeah.
And I just thought it's quite interesting that, you know, the Beatles were, I think we've said this before, were more like their parents' generation than we realize. And I think similarly, we are more like our parents' generation than we are. Realize. But
with the Beatles, it's possible that they were so physically close to each other anyway. You think of Hamburg, you think of 3 months.
That's spent, quite close enough, I would
3 months spent in the sleeping in the same room with no windows. You know, there's that wonderful incident where they're in a van once. Do you remember when the window broke and they all wrapped in their coats? And they just lay on top of each other with a bottle of whiskey, didn't they? Like emperor penguins trying to keep warm. So in terms of that, and they shared rooms. Very early days, they all shared rooms, didn't they? Shared rooms in hotels, even when they were doing quite well, you know. So nobody had a more kind of sense of physical closeness, I think, than the Beatles. They didn't need to demonstrate it, did they? At all.
Now, talking of bands with a great deal of physical closeness, Fleetwood Mac. Okay. None more, because a great deal of the physical closeness.
None more fractious.
A lot of the physical closeness within Fleetwood Mac over the years has taken place without the benefit of clothing, hasn't it, really? Because
the world's greatest living soap opera up there with
somewhat, somewhat closer than even the Beatles. Anyway, this has come back into view, hasn't it? In the last
Lindsay
week.
Buckingham, it's a thing in the LA Times, isn't it, recently?
Lindsay Buckingham, he's made a solo record, hasn't he? And he's out there promoting it. And so he's giving interviews. And the great tragedy of being Lindsay Buckingham is when people talk to Lindsay Buckingham, there's only one thing they're interested in, Fleetwood Mac. Because God bless Lindsay Buckingham, an absurdly talented person, you know, hugely important, but nobody's interested in him.
And he can't deal with it because he has made, let's be honest, he's made a lot of Lindsay Buckingham records. But my question to you is, does anybody want them? Do they sell? Do we know?
Well, selling records is a pretty ancient concept. Yeah, but I mean,
the world's not panting for the next Lindsay Buckingham.
No.
This is a personal pride issue, isn't it? This is the guy who I think feels that, you know, that 75% of the success of Fleetwood Mac is his songs and his guitar playing and his involvement in it. And therefore, he has every right to go out and promote his own career. Because he's got some history with this, hasn't he? He flounced out a while ago, didn't he? Claiming that it was 1987, I think, he flounced out saying his creativity was being stifled. Do you remember? Just before they went on tour. And he had to be replaced with Billy Burnett and Rick Vito.
Yes.
So two guitar players. Actually, it's interesting because this time, because what happened here was he wouldn't go on tour with them in 2018.
Well, he wanted, because he had his solo album to do.
Yeah. So he said to them, can't they delay the tour? They said no. He then tried to sue them to make them stop. Am I right? To try and delay the tour. This wasn't resolved. He then claimed he was fired. But actually, they said he wasn't fired. I mean, basically what happened, Irving Azov, the manager, basically said, well, look, the situation is Stevie Nicks, it's either Stevie Nicks or it's you. She's if you stay, she'll leave. And if you know what I mean? It's you've got to choose between one or the other. And the group obviously chose the singer, which is fair enough, isn't it? I mean, that makes sense.
Well,
he said it'd be like Mick Jagger saying, okay, you've got to choose between me and Keith Richards. So obviously, you know.
It's quite interesting in what it tells you about bands, because Stevie Nicks is kind of the most important personality in Fleetwood Mac, isn't she?
Yeah.
As far as the audience is concerned, if you buy your ticket to see Fleetwood Mac, and it'll cost you a lot of money, and if Stevie Nicks is not there, I think you're cross. I think you're cross. You're really
you
cross.
Want a kind of. You know, wispy-looking character in a black.
You want Stevie Nicks
floating around in the middle.
You want Stevie Nicks. I've said this before. Without Stevie Nicks, Fleetwood Mac are the Doobie Brothers. You know, they're just not very exciting. Stevie Nicks is the person who makes them exciting because she's a little bit weird and a little bit out there. You know, and so yes, they did decide on her. And so there he is. He's going out there giving interviews, plugging his album, talking.
What a bitch. He said something about her. Also, he said, she's very lonely. She's alone. Yeah. Oh, she has people who work for her. Yeah. I'm sure he has friends, but you know what I mean. I mean, I thought that's a really cruel and miserable thing to say. It's all that idea that she'd sacrifice her life, really, for the band. Just, there's no kind of, you know, family and husband and all that kind of stuff, you know.
And because he's just split up with his wife, hasn't he, as well?
Yeah.
And Liz Buckingham as well. Because the truth is that all of them, they've been married, they've been divorced, they've been married again, all kinds of strange things. In truth, they're only married to one thing, and that's Fleetwood Mac, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter whether you're in the group or they left you behind for this tour. That's what they're getting up in them every morning and thinking about, isn't it?
And you've got to admire the fact that they have, in a number of very difficult circs, they've kept it going. You know, even though he must be quite pleased about the fact that when he leaves, he's always replaced by two people. This time he's replaced by Neil Finn, wasn't it? He was singing, and Mike Campbell.
Two really good people.
Really, really, really good people, you know.
Yeah,
I just couldn't think of another group who is as internally fractious and litigious and combustible is the one. I mean, I don't know. Stones have their problems. You know, Mick Jagger went off and made his solo albums in the 80s, but he realised fairly soon that nobody wanted those solo albums, and he came back tail between legs and has never thought of, I don't think, of forsaking the group since, you know. I mean, the Everlys, that's on a tiny level. They absolutely loathed and detested each other. But Fleetwood Mac, there's nothing like him.
Do you ever study that time in the early 70s when there was another group called Fleetwood Mac was touring the United States, managed by Clifford Davis, who'd previously been the manager of Fleetwood Mac?
That's right. And sued
those them. Guys, they're, no, they eventually had to stop. They had to stop. But because they did a few shows and they just turned up, they were billed as Fleetwood Mac, and then there were just these guys, you know. And one of them was a former member of Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera. But
did the audience remonstrate, though? Did the audience think, hang on a second?
There's a bit of that. There's a bit of that. But the point is this: those guys who took part in that are still around and they still talk about it to this day, and they still say that Mick Fleetwood was supposed to join that tour. That was supposed to be the continuation of Fleetwood Mac without any of the troublesome bits that they wanted to ditch. And then suddenly it wasn't working out so well. And so Mick was in the middle of it going, oh, I knew nothing about it, and so forth. So they still say this to this day. And you know, I think there's something in that, you know, that was the point at which they would have switched totally, you know. It's an absolute...
I think they're in a good position, though, because they're in a position where if they could bear eventually, in 2 or 3 years' time, to resolve things with Lindsey Buckingham, they can come back with Lindsey Buckingham. And that would be a big commercial prospect, don't you think? Wouldn't people love the idea of seeing them all back together again?
There's always that, yeah, but the two things... The last tour with Neil Finn and Mike Campbell was very successful because Neil Finn and Mike Campbell are really, really good.
Yeah, and they play a load of Crowded House songs and all that sort of stuff as well. It's a really brilliant package.
The other thing is when you get a bunch of musicians who are staring down the face of 80 years old, not that far off, making long-term plans for tours, I would have thought it's quite a difficult business.
It's unwise.
Well, somebody's going to have a health problem,
the insurance is going to be ridiculous.
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So, one must hope out of all this that at least Lindsey Buckingham gets his promotional value for his solo record, which I'm sure is very good, you know, because I've got a few Lindsey Buckingham solo records and they're very good. Do I ever play them? Probably not.
Probably not.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So, funny thing about tennis, I've observed this over a long period of time. Whenever something remarkable and encouraging and heartening happens in the world of tennis, two things happen, and I'm going to test whether this is the case when I go for a walk this afternoon and go past my local tennis club. People like me, who over the years have played a lot of really crap tennis, watch these remarkable events and think, it's no point at all. I'll break my tennis racket, or I'll throw it into the bin or down the shed. I'll never pick it up again. And on the other hand, a larger number of people who've never played tennis in their lives
think, oh, that looks, how hard can it be?
They look at it, they think, how hard can that be? And so they go running down the park, don't they? You know, with kind of newly purchased tennis balls or whatever. Yeah.
And then new, crisp pair of shorts.
Then they find they can't even get it over the net, you know? because the basic level of technique that on display in these occasions, such as last night, is just on absolutely another level.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And of course, one thing about tennis is it sort of looks quite simple, don't you think? I've always found one of the most exciting things about watching pro tennis who get at Wimbledon and so forth is not so much the matches, it's the knockups, it's the hitting beforehand, where they just stand there and just put it on the same spot again and again and again for about 5 minutes. You think
that's got to be doable?
That's got to be doable. really hard, you know. I also know,
there were tiny moments last night where Fernandes particularly would get one across a little tiny drop shot, and you think, well, look, you know, Raducanu could just get to that, and she'd get to it, but then you realise as it landed, you could see the backspin.
Oh, absolutely!
So not only was it lobbed in some little pocket which was hard to access, but it was spinning backwards and bounced out of her way, and you think, God, the amount of skill.
Well, it's television never depicts that properly. The absolute the angles of these things. They're absolutely terrifying. But the other thing that struck me just reading the news this morning and looking at it, it's shall I draw a parallel between her success and the Beatles? Because, you know, everything is likened to the Beatles. She started at the absolute top. So it's like the Beatles arriving in America, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Here I am, fresh and my best. And at the absolute top.
And a good 10 years ahead of me, probably dominating.
Well, injuries are the big issue, I suppose, but, you know.
And the other lovely thing that we were saying the other day was that, you know, you get used to people in sport, kind of when they win, they're kind of, yes, you know, that's my right. You know, I'm simply ticking off the fact that that's another conquest that I can add to the list. And in her case, she's just as breathless and stunned and amazed and thrilled as we are.
It's a beautiful...
It's a lovely sight.
It's a beautiful thing to see. It really is.
Yeah,
and nothing will ever be the same again for her. Because
she'll be expected to win.
And she'll be expected to win. That's a totally different thing.
Different thing. Well, there was a lovely little quote this morning from Gareth Southgate saying, talking about teenagers and sport. He said, well, I picked this particularly young England team. Because I didn't want people who were lumbered with the burden of failure. I thought that was a really interesting point. You know, that the older you get, the more you can see how things can go wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
And when you're 18, you just think, right, let's go to America and see what happens. Yeah. We might have to cancel our flight home early if we're very lucky, but I doubt it. You know, and that's just.
But once you've done it once, it's never quite the same again, is it?
No,
I'm talking as if I've done it.
I know.
You know, it's never glad, confident morning again, as the old poem goes.
Yeah.
But that was glad, confident morning, undoubtedly.
And the other lovely thing is that. You know, you get people just coming out of nowhere. I kept bumping into people yesterday saying, can I watch Emma? Are you watching Emma this evening? She should do it in two. She should do it in two. You think, what? Where did this come from?
Oh, I hate that. Like, I hate that referring to sports stars by their first name, as if they're your next door neighbour or something like that.
Really funny.
As if you've been throwing their ball back for the last 10 years, you know. Yeah, you haven't really. So
it reminded me of that thing. Was it in Dazed and Confused that we were looking at the other day about the thing about real fans?
Oh, right.
Yeah, you know, the idea that there was a brilliant clip, which I think we've talked about before, with Tim Lovejoy, the Sky presenter, interviewing Martin Freeman. And he's wearing a Ramones T-shirt. And Martin Freeman goes, so Ramones. Okay, right. Name one member of the Ramones. And there's a pause, and then he looks at his T-shirt, and he sees it written on it is Johnny, Joey, he says, no, and then Marty says, no, all right, okay, forget that. It's written on your shirt. Name one track by the Ramones. And he's unable to do it. And his whole thing is, you know, that this is outrageous that people are now wearing these T-shirts who in a sense almost don't have a right to do so. And the piece in Days Confused about the fact that I think, is it Kourtney Kardashian? Has been wearing a Cure T-shirt. So, of course, Cure fans and a lot of other people are thinking, is she really that devoted to the Cure, or does that just say the right thing about her? And is there any proof that she's ever listened to this group? And I love it because it's got to the point now where some people are arguing that, you know, you've got to pass some kind of test to prove that you're a real fan.
You see, that's the
ludicrous
thing, isn't it?
It's a ludicrous concept in itself. Yeah.
People always talk about this when there's a controversy over how difficult tickets are to get for live shows, you know. And you say, you know, if they go on these secondary markets or whatever,
yeah,
the real fans are cut out. Well, I don't know. I don't know if real fan is a concept that holds water at all. You know, because how do you measure this? You know, do you measure a real fan on the basis that they've been there the longest? Or do you measure on the basis they've spent more money than anybody else, or they've travelled further than everybody else?
Yeah, amount of records owned, amount of bootlegs.
And is that a good thing?
Ability to name B-sides.
You know, if you're a performer, I often think this when I go to see Bob Dylan, you know, that the first kind of 10 rows are absolutely occupied by real fans to the extent they've been watching him for 40 years. And they're just a bit jaded, aren't they, really? You know, if you are Bob Dylan, you'd probably rather go on stage in front of a bunch of 35-year-olds who hadn't seen you before.
Never seen you. One of the problems with the people in the front row is that they're not really enjoying it. And I know, because I've said those phrases, they're not enjoying it, you know, because they've always got some reason to be disappointed. He didn't play this song. He didn't play the verse that he sometimes include the verse that he sometimes includes in that song. They've seen so much of it, they've got so much to compare with that they're just ticking it off as another thing they went to, going home feeling a bit miserable, you know. Which must be the most difficult people to play to. Christ.
I'm sure they are. And the other thing is, you know, the idea that that just because you've been listening to somebody or seen somebody for a long, long time, you kind of know more about them than somebody who's picked them up relatively recently.
Well, that's not really true anymore.
It's not really true anymore. That's the thing that struck me. It struck me a few times in the last year while talking to the guys who run the Nothing Is Real podcast, the Beatles one.
Beatles one, yeah.
And these are two Irish guys who I'm guessing they're in the 30s and 40s or something like that. You know, they know more about the Beatles than you and I do. And we grew up with the Beatles, don't they?
They've got that kind of freshness of that energy of, you know, and there's more available to find out.
There's more available to find out. Far more.
Reading things to, yeah.
Far more. And so I think you could say the same thing, you know, you know, the people who know more about Bruce Springsteen or Steely Dan or whoever will not necessarily be the people who grew up with them. There'll be another generation who's come along. And also,
when did T-shirts start? I can't really remember now. I remember seeing Keith Richards wearing a Bob Marley T-shirt, Earl's Court, 1976. And I mean, obviously, we'd started before that. But when did that whole idea that you advertise your... Because when we were kids, I mean, the way you expressed your affection for a group was... I don't know, writing their name on your exercise,
you wrote their name
on the exercise book and you carried their album about.
More than that. No, I'll tell you what I did, Mark, if you're like me, and this may ring a bell with older listeners, you used to carry your books to school, stuff to school, in a kind of ex-army kit bag that you bought the Army and Navy stores.
Upon which you'd written Chicken Shack in Byron.
Absolutely. You would, and then they had a kind of bobbly surface when you got close to them. So they were the world's least friendly surface on which to inscribe the names of, you know, the animals. Chicken Shack, as you correctly, Vinegar Joe, Rory Gallagher, whatever. Gallagher. And you would do it with a biro on the thing, and very often spell them wrong or something.
That's right.
And you'd be stuck with them for absolutely years. But in terms of T-shirts, I mean, T-shirts were always there, but you couldn't afford them. And a wide range of them would not be available. And you started to get merchandise. Well, merchandise became a regular feature of gig going at a certain level from the 80s, didn't it, really?
Yeah.
It wasn't a big thing in the 70s. No, it wasn't. You might.
I suppose there were tour T-shirts, but there must have been, because there are occasionally see people wearing, 70s tour T-shirts. But otherwise, I don't think there was, actually.
Very often, if you're looking at a 70s tour T-shirt, that's it's a replica.
Yeah.
Made in the 90s to look like the 70s. But the other thing that struck me about, how do you identify real fans? You know, there's only a certain number of tickets to go and see whoever. They should go to the real fans. All right, what are you going to do that? How are you going to work that out? Are you going to introduce
written exam?
Written
exam. So you've got a proof of musical ownership. You've got all right. Here's one. You've got a recitation of an entire lyric.
There you go.
Revelation of obscure but true fact.
They'll have people going amongst the audience, tapping people on the shoulder and just quietly asking them to accompany them outside.
That's right.
Because they've been replaced by somebody who knows more than you do, who's a bigger fan than you are, who's come further, who's sacrificed more than you. He doesn't make any sense.
I think you're going to be shown a photograph of the act. You've got to say when and where it was taken. Good, isn't it? We can do that in the Beatles. Once you recognise all their facial hair and haircuts and clothes, I can pretty much date most Beatles speeches. But yeah, it needs some kind of, I think it's a written what line comes next in this lyric? It's that kind of thing, isn't it?
It needs policing. And the sooner the better.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Any other business? Correspondence from the Massive. Interesting, following up something I think we were talking about last week, Stephen Lamb, who describes himself modestly, fair enough, as a resident Yes expert. All right, fair enough. You can
fiercely
have that job.
Contested slot.
You can have that job, Stephen, that's fine. We were talking about the Iron Butterfly PA. Aren't you sorry you missed that?
You're in the deep end of the Word in Your Ear podcast, aren't you there?
We were talking about the Iron Butterfly PA, which Yes inherited when they supported them on tour in the late 60s. And he says the point wasn't just that the PA sounded better. It also had monitoring, almost for the first time, so a band could hear themselves play. So played, and more importantly, sang in tune. Very good point, Stephen. Absolutely good point. Because that was one of the things I think we remarked upon last week. That they could not only play, they could also sing. And they could all sing, which really made a difference. So having their PA helped them in this. Darren Leithley, who I think is getting in touch from Dublin, it says, following the late cancellation of the cricket, the England-India test, which was called off with like 2 hours before the start the other day, he says, have you ever been to a gig where the act didn't make it to the stage? And he says he's had two cases, both of which were weather-related. I think this is in Dublin. Scritability were delayed on the Holyhead Dublin ferry and couldn't get there on the day. And the National, where we're still trekking across a frozen island from somewhere down the southwest, up to the Olympia Theatre, so they didn't make it to that show. And this reminded me, I think I've got a bit of a collector's item here, actually, Mark.
Actually went to a gig where the band didn't turn up.
No, I'm going to go further. I went to a gig where the band did turn up but didn't play. I went to, this is way back in 1968. I went to what was supposed to be a mammoth all-nighter at the Queen's Hall, a former tram turning shed in Leeds. Okay. The least hospitable
you can possibly
keep
imagine. Your greatcoat on.
Absolutely. More to the point, I was doing a bit of research on this, and I think it was February, so it must have been pretty damn chilly. And I think you're absolutely right. I did keep my army
surplus.
No, it was actually navy greatcoat, navy blue greatcoat on all the way. And what's more, I walked all the way home, which is a considerable distance. Clearly, no all-night transport in those days. Anyway, he was supposed to see a load of acts, including Chuck Berry and including The Herd. And I do remember The Herd. But The Move, I really wanted to see The Move. And this was The Move were at their kind of the peak of their powers, really. The classic line of The Move. Let's just, let's remind ourselves once more. Trevor Burton, Bev Bevan, Carl Wayne, Ace the Singing Skull Kefford, and Roy Wood. Okay. God, I love The Move. And this is the year, must have been the year of Blackberry Way and so forth, And what I remember about The Move is that they couldn't play because I think their equipment had arrived. And instead, they trooped on stage and just stood there.
Oh, that makes it worse. It
sort of makes it worse.
Yeah. Why can't they borrow somebody else's?
I suppose so. But we just accepted it. And I suppose that was the promoter's way of
our weary way home.
Getting around people demanding their money back. Well, you saw The Move. You didn't see them play, but there they clearly were. That's the five members of The Move. So that's my contribution to that. Have you ever turned up?
I've never been to a gig where the band didn't play. I mean, the only thing I got close to was, in terms of delay, was the famous Nebworth 1976.
Right.
10cc came on an hour and a half late because the Stones Roses had cut through all the cables to delay them while Keith Richards recovered from over-intoxication. But no, I've never actually not seen a... I've never been to a gig where they didn't turn up.
Oh, well.
That would have been mortifying.
Royston Vince says, would people be too embarrassed to see certain bands because of their names? And the example he proposes is Throbbing Gristle. What bands have particularly embarrassing names?
Well, we talked about Prefab Sprout before. I always found it very hard to talk publicly about my affection for Prefab Sprout. It's such a terrible name. We Got Married in a Fever. It comes from that line, doesn't it? But that doesn't excuse the fact that the band are called Prefab Sprout, which is so frightful. The was just the most.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
simply
terrible.
Awful. Smashing Pumpkins, I thought, was an absolutely dreadful name. I couldn't see anything remaining. And the thing that embarrassed me, and I can remember, starting out as a music kind of journalist and trying to explain to my parents what I was doing. And occasionally they'd sort of ring up and say, what are you up to? And I remember telling them, and where it was, 79, 80, and I was going on the road with the band. And they're very excited about this and thought, well, what's that entail? And what is the band called? I can remember the terrible pause before I said, they're called Bow Wow Wow. And it's really hard to hold your head up and give the impression that you've got a serious job that might be going somewhere.
Yeah,
on the road with Bow Wow Wow.
Your dad's not telling people at work about that.
He's not.
Yes,
no,
my boy's off with Bow Wow Wow.
But it's amazing how quickly any band's name, you just kind of forget what any
references
there might be, and they just become the name,
Yeah.
How about you? Anyone you just couldn't bear?
Oh, I couldn't think really of people that I actually went on the road with. What I'd be too embarrassed to say, but I always think there's certain names that will you'll never get over. Like Dumpy's Rusty Nuts and things like Tucky Buzzard. It's those kind of things.
Brewer's Droop. Yeah.
Budgie. Brewer's Droop. It's a certain kind of lumpen.
It is.
They deserve to be at the bottom of the bill with those kind of names, It's quite interesting. The contrast.
Never going to fly.
Somebody drew my attention to this a few years ago, that the great Motown groups all had names that were aspirational. The Temptations.
Yeah.
The Supremes. The Miracles.
Marvelettes. Yeah,
the Velvelettes. The Marvelettes. They were all... They were all reaching for the stars, those names. Dumpy's Rusty Nuts are doing something directly opposite, aren't they?
Yeah.
Where they're kind of taking the mickey out of themselves first to save you the trouble of doing it after. There's no aspiration in naming a group Dumpy's Rusty Nuts or even Bow Wow Wow, really. You know what I mean? They're kind of names that are running from success.
They're limiting, aren't they?
Prefab Sprout's another case.
Terrible, because they're such a wonderful group.
Yeah.
And it just seems to misrepresent them completely.
Anyway, I've had some correspondence from James Carter. And James wanted to know why we haven't had Peter Frampton on Word in Your Attic. And there's a reason for this, Mark.
We tried.
And you know, we went through the channels and they were going to do it. But they said, Peter, I don't know if this is coming from Peter or his various, you know, intermediaries or whatever, representatives on Earth. They said he won't do it in Vision.
And of all people, not want to do it in Vision. Sorry, but Peter Frampton, at one stage, literally the world's the best-looking man in rock, and still fantastic.
Absolutely.
Well-presented. I mean, he looks fabulous.
He looks fabulous. And we said, oh, well, this is such a shame. We like Peter Frampton. We'd love to talk to Peter Frampton. But on that occasion, he wouldn't do it in Vision. And we said, tell you what, we're not really set up to do audio only of these things at the moment. Let's just forget it. So that's
yeah, because it was a word in your attic, wasn't it? It was going to be him digging out your old records and talking about a book he got there. Yeah. That's a shame. So that's the reason. That's true.
Mike Gray says, are ticket prices too high now for the casual fan to take a chance on a show? Short answer, Mike, yes.
Didn't somebody respond to that tweet you're saying that they'd looked at the Eric Clapton ticket prices and there was one for £4,500? That can't be right.
Well, it could be, I suppose. It could be in a box with some kind of hospitality package.
With a very expensive dinner thrown in.
Yeah. I mean,
you get to go on holiday for a week with Eric Clapton afterwards. I don't know.
Yeah, you can find tickets at eye-watering prices, but even without going to those lengths. You know, basically, as we've said many times, when Led Zeppelin were in their pomp, 1972 or whatever, it cost £2.50 to go and see them and £2.99 to buy their record. You know, so it was cheaper to go and see somebody than to buy their record. And then it just switched and it's gone. You know, that gap has got greater and greater ever since. So, you know, people did used to just turn up to see bands, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, certainly in clubs.
There's no spontaneity left, is there?
And
so let's take a chance on this.
You can't do that. I mean, you know, how much would you pay to go and see somebody that people say, oh, they're quite good, you know, just you ought to check them out, as they say in the music business. How much would you pay to just check them out, Mark Allen? What's the point at which you say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not paying that much to see somebody?
This is what a group that I've never heard of.
Yeah, well, if I've told you that they're quite good, actually. Go on, how much are you going to spend?
It's beyond 25 quid a risk. It is, isn't it?
It is. I wouldn't expect you to pay, because you're paying it for two people, probably. You know.
Yeah.
So it's quite an expensive evening out.
That really is crippling.
I think as to your point, Mike, I think they are too high now for the casual fan to take a chance. But I think they probably have been for quite a while. So we have various people noting the passing of Michael Chapman. I'm going to make a confession here. I don't know anything about Michael Chapman.
I don't much either. I saw him in the Marquee once, and I wrote a review about him for the Enemy. Oh, well. But I mean, and he played lots of ragtime. I can remember lots of slightly jazz things. He was very kind of Django Reinhardt. And all I can remember about Michael Chapman was, apart from that, he made 40 records, which I can't say I've listened to very many of, was that Peel used to go on about him a lot. Do you remember? John Peel used to love him. He always used to play Postcards of Scarborough on his show.
All right.
But no, I didn't. And I think a lot of people got confused with Roger Chapman. So, you know, but, you know, what a career. Fantastic. Oh,
yeah, long innings. And one of those people who probably had a greater following late in life than he would have had, you know, back in his 20s or something, you know, because it's like the Nick Drake effect, isn't it? Really?
Completely.
People go around looking for rediscovering 70s acoustic singer-songwriters and so forth. Phil Turner wanted us to talk about Fleetwood Mac. We've done that already, haven't we?
We have. We've given Lindsay Buckingham a pretty good shoeing, I think.
Chris Richards says, which albums will be better for being shorter, excluding doubles? All of them, Chris, basically. They could all records could stand to be shorter. It's just in 35 minutes. The LP record, which is the standard format, was the standard format, was set at 35 to 40 minutes because that's what it took to accommodate extend a piece of classical music, three movements of a symphony. There is no earthly reason why, you know, Bow Wow Wow or anybody should be best represented by that number of songs. It's just what they ended up doing.
And it got worse when CDs arrived, because then instead of having whatever it was, 40 minutes, you then had an hour. Oh, my Lord.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if I totally agree, because I think there's something rather exciting about the value of an album, that the slightly iffy tracks, the ones that make you appreciate the other ones more, if you listen to it as an album.
Okay.
But there were certain examples, my God, on I'm a Gummer by The Floyd, there was a track called Several Species of Small Furry Animals Gathered Together in a Cave and Grooving with a Pict. Do you remember that? And it was just a series of really annoying sound effects. And that, oh, my God, it was rotten. You just prayed that wasn't on the record. But there's a really good example, the Yola Tango, who I quite like. Yola Tango made a record called And Then Nothing Turned Itself Inside Out. And all their records are too long. They're all over an hour. And this ends with a final song called Night Falls on Hoboken. And how long is that, Dave? This is a record that's already way too long. This is the last track. How long is that track?
God, I don't know.
17 minutes, 42 seconds.
Oh, God.
Can you imagine? Oh, my Lord.
Have you ever read that wonderful spoof of Yola Tango in The Onion?
Oh, yeah. Their audience, that's right.
Oh, God, it's funny. They were
they're all kind of librarians and nerds that people go to listen to them.
It's absolutely brilliant. So it's time to welcome new Patreon supporters. Always a pleasure, never a chore. Alan Probert, old friend of ours, who's out now. Well, we had him
in Australia. Lovely fella.
He was transported years ago, wasn't he? Sent to Van Diemen's Land or something. But lovely to
hear Palm.
Yeah, lovely to hear from you, Alan. Scott Blackie. And Cahal Chu, and as an Access All Areas patron supporter. So we'll be finding out more there. David Cook, also similar. Adrian Craddock, John Penny, and Paul Desmond. Lovely to have you all on board. And if you'd like to join them, the place to do it to find out how you could get access to all areas, to absolutely everything we do, in full, in living color where applicable, is by going to patreon.com/wordinyourear for further details.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.